This is Ridgely Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to start out the first of two conversations here dealing with addiction and helping deal with addiction with conversation with Herb Steverson, who is He is the Director of Outreach and the Intervention Coordinator for an organization which is called True Intervention Service. They're based here in Northwest Indiana, in fact, here in Merrillville. And Mr. Steverson, thanks for being with us today. Spend a little time. Tell us more about the creation of True Interventions and some of the services that the folks there are putting together to help folks in Northwest Indiana deal with their addictions.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. We're actually two companies operating under the same roof, True Interventions and USA Addiction. And we do a lot more than just interventions. We do sober coaching. We do family coaching. We do consults for various agencies, public speaking. We do interventions, of course. We can also assist families with treatment referrals, helping them navigate the world of rehabilitation. And just try our best to be that constant resource for families who don't know where to turn to help their struggling loved one. We opened our doors as True Interventions in August of 2018. And since we've been there, we've helped nearly 2,000 people find recovery. And our goal for this year is to help 3,500.
Is it surprising that even only being open less than a year, or just over a year perhaps, that you've had so many people come in and then been able to help them out?
Not surprising at all. I myself am in recovery. I struggled with heroin addiction, cocaine, alcohol for 13 years and tried to get clean multiple times, but there just weren't any resources available. There were either waiting lists for beds. I was uninsured. I didn't have the means. I didn't have the funds. I couldn't get out of state. And that's just me, you know. So there's still not enough supply to meet the demand. For every 2,000 people that we help, there's millions still struggling.
When you talk about the True Intervention Services and what you do here in Northwest Indiana and the partners that you've been able to set up, what organizations do you get to partner with to help people out once they come in for referral or come in on their own and asking for help?
Well, we don't necessarily partner with anyone, mm-hmm. But we just do have a large working knowledge of treatment providers throughout the country and here in Northwest Indiana. When it comes to putting together an intervention, we spend a great deal of time working with the family because getting their loved one into a rehab facility, a treatment center, is just a very small portion of the whole process. We believe that if the family doesn't change, the addict never will. So what we do is we actually execute a team day or a family day. We pull the whole family together and really get them on the same page so that the denial can end, the objections, the manipulations and the hijacking and everything that an addict subjects their loved one to. That way they're better prepared to love their or to help their loved one rather when they come home from treatment. And when it comes to getting them into a center, I mean everything is case by case. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody's indigent, if they have absolutely no means or funds whatsoever, then we would look to a facility that's free, low cost, state funded. And then if they do have, the means or the insurance or whatever, we want to make sure that we're getting the loved one into a good fit program, but also a place that's not going to break their family's bank, because so many people, they tend to fall subject to that whole Google search. And just because they have a great website and they're close to me, that might be a good fit for my loved one. But what we've found over the years of doing what we do is that even if the best program in the world is in your backyard, it might not be a good fit for your person because, they can just walk out after they start feeling better.
Take a few minutes and tell us a little about the issues of I guess, costs in a way, I guess. And one of the things you mentioned in some of your materials, talking about the price of addiction versus the price of being treated for an addiction. What first would be some of the price of addiction that and we're talking personal as well as monetary, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. On the financial side of things, using the word cost, I actually went through what they refer to as a CDNA program, chemical dependency and addiction program. through Porter Stark years ago, and we actually did a workshop or a worksheet. We did a class on the cost of our actual addiction. And when we factored in our daily using habits, hotel rooms, the rituals of using, bond money, lawyer's fees, commissary, over the years, mine actually added up to be over $1 million. Uh-huh. So that's just me personally. And then, of course, the non-financial costs, loss of life, loss of quality of life, loss of peace of mind, loss of parents, loss of children, psychosis, just horrible misery and living that nightmare of addiction day after day. You know, me personally, my addiction took me to places that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. I was eating out of garbage cans. I was sleeping outside, sleeping in abandoned buildings, holding cardboard signs, begging for change, shaking plastic cups, panhandling, all just to kind of, you know, finance my own self-destruction. But I didn't know how to get out of it. You know, so the cost of addiction are you can't number it. I mean, it's just horrible. There's no good that can come out of it. But the cost of recovery, you know, so many people kind of get lost that they think that, you know, rehab is this $30,000 investment and there's just no way that we can afford it. And that's part of the reason why we exist. We do offer honest third party referrals to programs based on need. You know, we know that by the time you're reaching out to us, you're exhausted in every sense of the word, emotionally, financially, physically, spiritually, what have you. So we want to put together something that's actually doable for you. I just got a gentleman into a program yesterday that is very affordable, and he didn't think that recovery was even possible for him. You know, so we use our network to put together something. You know, there's programs that are as cheap as $1,500 for 30 days, yeah. Detox plus 30 days, you know, but people have to reach out and let us get to know the situation so that we can find a placement that best fits their needs.
Well, you talk about having such a network of partners and organizations that you can work with to help get somebody the help that they need. I assume that these are probably organizations that are not only medical, because you're talking about doctors and the like, and probably even in some cases mental health assistance, but also spiritual assistance in dealing with working with churches to deal with issues too, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. When it comes to putting together a treatment plan for Junior or for Timmy, however you want to refer to him as or her, is one size doesn't fit all. What works for me may not work for you, may not work for you. So that's why we spend such a great deal of time getting to know the client through your eyes, getting to know the family, getting to know, are you a faith-based family? Would a faith-based track work for you? We're not going to offer a Christian track to a person who's a devout atheist. That's going to actually turn him off from treatment. So, of course, there's the medical, there's the detox, there's the, you know, multiple modalities of treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy, 12-step, non-12-step. But what we aim to do is put together a treatment plan that is holistic, that will treat the whole person. It may even include a faith-based track, a non-faith-based, but also experiential therapy. Maybe they'll go surfing. Maybe they'll go fishing. Maybe they'll go on spiritual hikes into the wilderness and meditate. That's why we truly get to know the real you, so we can put together a plan that will show you that recovery is cool, that recovery is something that will work for you.
When you talk about addiction in that's kind of a general term, but it really is broken down into, I guess, in a way, specialties. Go through, if you will, what, and you folks there at True Intervention Service deal with when you talk about going down to talk to somebody and you realize they have different types of addiction. And we're talking about not only chemical addiction, but psychological addiction too, aren't we? Especially when you get into like the gambling addictions.
Oh, absolutely. We can basically intervene on anything. We've done process addiction, we've done retail, we've done hoarding, eating disorders, gambling, sex, failure to launch, and then, of course, your substance abuse. But we can also intervene on mental health as well, you know, unmedicated bipolar, schizophrenia. We're very well equipped to handle just about any situation.
When you get people involved in dealing, first off, recognizing if – like you say, you end up probably getting many people come in asking for help. And like you say, kind of the end of the line, they may have gone through the addiction process, maybe even, I suppose, even for some, the treatment process, but something hasn't worked in the past and they come to you, I'm sure, as a, maybe not quite as a last resort, but pretty close to last resort.
Yes. It's actually funny that you say that, because a lot of times when I'm speaking to families, wherever they're from and whatever the addiction or issue is I typically tend to say that if you're talking to me, we're in the 11th hour. Mm-hmm. You've tried everything. You've threatened, you've pleaded, you've punished, you've, you know, bribed, you've, you know, done everything that you possibly can within your ability to change this situation. And by the time you're reaching out to me, we know you're desperate. So we definitely want to make sure that, you know, the family know that this is a viable option. You know, it's not just a shot in the dark.
Now, you're not the only person, obviously, there at the center helping people out, but you have others, your colleagues that in turn have their own specialties. What type of specialties do these folks bring to the table to help people that are addicted?
Well, everybody that operates under our roof is a nationally certified family recovery coach. We have certified intervention professionals on our staff. We have our clinical director, Linda Sward, who I can't even tell you how many credentials she has. She's a two-time mental health worker of the year through the Indiana Department of Corrections. She's a CADAC. She's board registered. She's licensed. And every case plan that we put together actually goes through her. With the assessments and evaluations that we offer, they're 100% ASAM compliant, which is the American Society of Addiction Medicine. But we are a team. It's not just Herb. It's not just Brian. It's not Linda. Anytime we bring on a case file, we bounce it off of each other. And that way we can always come up with new ideas and, you know, keep things fresh and, you know, because I don't know everything, you know.
Do you find, too, that obviously being a team such as that is making it easier for the person that's coming in asking for help to be able to not only get the help that they need, but also get the financial support that they may need, too? They may have to maybe go through FSA or other organizations with the state or even federal government to be able to help get the work done and be able to get the problem solved. But they have to have approval, and you have to have the credentials, I suppose, to be able to show the folks who may help out at the other end and the financial end that these folks are real and they're going to help do the work that needs to be done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, teamwork makes the dream work, you know, from our standpoint and a family's as well. You know, when a full family unit is on board and everybody is ready to take this thing on, this intervention on, this and put a stop to this, it really just it kills the holes in the dam, so to speak, you know. Recovery demands exposure. And when you get the enablers together, I hate to use that word, but when mm-hmm. you get the enablers, when you get the people who are in denial, when you get the people, you know, who have kind of just stayed away from this Timmy the Addict situation, and you all get them to come together as if he had cancer, that's when you get results. You know, if there's no confrontation, there's no transformation.
Do law enforcement agencies help you out in a way? Do you get referrals in many cases from the police or from ambulance services or hospitals that they've come across somebody that needs a little bit more help than maybe what they can help at the moment do?
All the time. We have the PARI or PARI, which is the Police Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative, set up with various agencies throughout Northwest Indiana. We handle referrals from coroners, from sheriffs, from prosecutors, from defense attorneys, from churches. People are always sending referrals our way because this is our specialty. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what we focus on.
Now, finally, tell us a little bit about the website. When people go on trueinterventions.com, what will they see? And if they in turn have questions, they can get them answered. Or if they actually are to the point, say, I need help, can you help me out? What can you find at least to get started on the website?
Oh, goodness. You can go to true-interventions.com. That's intervention plural. Mm-hmm. You can go to usaaddiction.com. You can go to freeaddictionguide.com. USAAdirect.com, which is actually a website that we have set up. It basically mirrors our USA Addiction site, but we actually have information that can be downloaded via ebook that gives, you know, some pointers and tips and do's and don'ts and, you know, just an overview of what families can start to change right this instant when it comes to loving a loved one, loving an addict. But what they'll also see is they'll see videos of myself, Jay, Nick, Linda. They'll see blogs that we've written, links to various articles and news segments that we've been featured in. There's a call now button. There's a sign up for email alerts button. Basically, our entire company is at your fingertips when you visit our website.
Well, Herb, thank you for spending time with us talking about the organization that you work with, the team that you work with, and helping find ways for people that have all types of addictions to be able to get the help that they need and hopefully get their issues resolved before it's too late, to be sure. Thanks for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Herb Steverson is the Director of Outreach, and he's Intervention Coordinator for USA Addiction LLC and its companion organization, True Intervention Service, and they're based here in Northwest Indiana. The Indianapolis-based Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation is sending grants to school districts and nonprofits across the state to help set up drug prevention programs in the fight against opioid addiction and overdoses. Claire Fidian Green, the president and CEO of the foundation, was with us here on Originally Speaking to talk about one grant that is going out here in Northwest Indiana to the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County to support their Partners in Prevention program for local schools.
We took a look at the landscape as we were learning about the opioid crisis and its impact on Indiana. And also, you mentioned our very high smoking rate. Indiana has one of the highest smoking rates in the country. And we took a look at what were the available resources coming from the state and other funders to help address these crises. And we saw the biggest emphasis was on helping people get into treatment who were struggling right now with an opioid use disorder or addiction. What we didn't see a lot of was prevention, and we thought the old adage certainly holds true that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So we decided to put together an initiative that we call Prevention Matters, and we identified the very best proven prevention programs that actually start as early as elementary school, and we launched, with the support of our board, a $12 million initiative over 3 years to help connect K-12 schools with proven substance use prevention programs, grades K-12. Mm-hmm. So we have committed $11.9 million toward that initiative, and we believe very strongly that we should collaborate with everybody who's trying to tackle the opioid crisis and other substance use challenges around the state, including meth or whatever the challenge might be in a given community. So we have partnered with other foundations like the LaPorte County Foundation, to help give them the tools that we've used in Marion County so that they can replicate Prevention Matters in their own community.
That's important, I think, to note that besides coming up with the grants to help school corporations and individual schools put together these K-12 prevention programs, it's all showing that that education is all basically the way that you help get the word out to not only starting very young, but even to grown-ups as well, I imagine, to let them know that it's not wise to find yourself in the situation where you might become addicted to such drugs.
That's absolutely right, yes. And if you start as early as elementary school, what you're really doing is helping equip students with good decision-making skills so that when they're presented with an opportunity to try a drug or to experiment with alcohol, they might make a better choice. And in fact, the proven prevention programs that our initiative is supporting have proven just that they are effective at helping young people make not only good short-term decisions, but long-term decisions that help them avoid problems with addiction over the long term.
I know you've had a chance to look through a lot of the paperwork that comes about from the organizations that have asked to be involved in the prevention program, Partners in Prevention in particular, which is the one that the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte has established. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how it's gotten started and in turn has certainly gotten the attention of the Fairbanks Foundation to begin with?
Yes. Yeah, so as I mentioned, we believe very strongly in collaboration, and we convene a group of funders from all around the state, including the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, who are interested in trying to tackle the opioid crisis and other substance misuse challenges in their community. And so we, as we were developing Prevention Matters, we shared all of the information that we had developed and the research we'd done and tools, as well as the design of our Prevention Matters initiative. And the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte County, under the direction of Maria Fruth, the president and CEO, took the initiative to adapt that model for LaPorte County, and they call it Partners in Prevention. Mm-hmm. So I certainly would defer to her for more details about how they are going about doing that, but we have been very happy to come alongside them and provide information and resources to them as they launch that initiative serving schools in LaPorte County.
I would imagine that probably in each instance here, for each organization that has gotten financial assistance through the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, that they all have their own certain little type of program, and certainly in this case that Partners in Prevention for LaPorte County is the same way too. But there have to be some common keys, I would imagine, for between all of them and to be able to get the funding support and to become part of this this overall, I guess you could call it a network, I suppose, in a way of drug prevention programs. What are, if there are any particular points or keys that they all seem to have in common?
Yeah, so I think the very first is the willingness of the leadership of the school and the teachers and other staff in the school to provide this type of programming to students, and we've seen lots of enthusiasm from schools that are involved in prevention initiatives. And then we have a very select group of proven prevention programs that applicants were allowed to select from, and so we connected them with technical assistance providers who are experienced with implementing prevention programs in schools to help schools identify the program that best met the population needs of the students that they are serving and the community in which they're located. So that was number one, is making sure it's actually a proven prevention program that has long-term evidence that it's effective at helping young people avoid substance misuse and eventually addiction. The second is these programs really are all about, at their essence, social and emotional well-being. It's equipping students with good decision-making tools so that will serve them well in all areas of their life, and certainly when it comes to making good decisions about drugs and alcohol. So those are key. And then the final thing is making sure that it's a cost-effective program, and all of the ones that we selected are cost-effective and can be sustained over the long term. Once they get up and running, the schools figure out how to incorporate the program into the regular school schedule and then train their staff so that it can be provided over the long term within their schools.
If there's any place that anyone can find more information about the overall Prevention Matters program, and perhaps, of course, they can, of course, find out more locally, in this case with LaPorte County, by getting in touch with the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte and individually, is there any place that the Prevention Matters program overall has information people can check out if they'd like to find out more, especially since they may be concerned about programs that might be set up in their school?
On our website, which is RM. As in Mary, FF as in Frank, .org/Prevention Matters. People can look for information on our website. And then I do encourage people in LaPorte to obviously take a look at the resources available at the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte and on their website.
That's Claire Fittigan-Green with the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation. The assistance to the LaPorte Foundation totals about $2 million over the next 4 years. 12 LaPorte County schools, public, charter, and private, are choosing their programs now with the intention of implementing them this fall. This is Regionally Speaking. For whatever reason it may be, Americans seem to see each other differently, depending on whether they happen to live in urban communities or in suburban communities or out in the countryside, for that matter, too. That is drawn based from polling and from analysis by academicians and others, that we seem to be divided culturally by geography. Well, that's what the Indiana Humanities has decided to take on in a major project that's going to basically last the next 2 years. And with us to talk about this program, which is entitled Inseparable, that's IN for Indiana, the abbreviation, of course, we have with us today Kira Amstutz. She's the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities. And Kira, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, Chris, I'm delighted. You guys are such a terrific partner up in the northwest part of the state, and happy to be with you.
Well, maybe did we talk about Indiana Humanities? Maybe you recognize the organization because we have been bringing in the past year or so the Quantum Leap Initiative comments, the programs that they've come out of Indianapolis to bring to northwest Indiana. And let's talk now about the importance, I guess, of the planning that you all did to come up with this rather interesting dynamic dealing with rural and urban life in Indiana that's kind of led into the creation of the Inseparable Initiative.
Absolutely. So Indiana Humanities is a statewide nonprofit, and we work in all 92 counties across the state. And so one of the great benefits of having that kind of a wide-ranging audience is that we get out and we get to hear what people care about. And I think that particularly during the state bicentennial year in 2016, and certainly since then, we've heard a lot of Hoosiers say, you know, you hear in the media all the time that there's such a gap between rural and urban, that the issues aren't the same, that people don't care about the same things. And I think our observation on the ground is, I think these perceived divisions are overblown. And what we see is a real consistency in what Hoosiers care about, why they appreciate the state, what they hope for with their families. And so we've decided to spend the next couple of years, we have a whole dizzying array of programs we can talk about and ways people can participate, but thinking a little bit about this perceived divide and thinking about why does it matter that we as Hoosiers have a common identity, that we can come together around issues to solve problems. I know you just had Claire, Fitty, and Green on, and my goodness, the marvelous things they're doing to help fight smoking, you know, help bring down the smoking rate and work on the opioid crisis and certainly focusing on education. You know, again, I think there's so much more that we Hoosiers have in common than what divides us, and we're hoping that we can have some conversations about that.
I know that the overall aim or goal, I guess, is to be able to take advantage of the humanities. And when you talk about the humanities, of course, that encompasses a lot of things, literature, history, poetry, philosophy, other related disciplines together to help try and bring rural and urban families and organizations and communities together.
You betcha. I mean, we have some unique tools in the humanities. And One of the favorite tools that we have is certainly reading and discussion. So one of the programs that we're really excited to announce, and this was just unveiled yesterday at the State House. We were glad that the Lieutenant Governor was with us and helped us pull the curtain off the new book that we're encouraging Hoosiers to read over the course of the next year, and it's called The Year We Left Home, and mm-hmm. it's by Jean Thompson. And so for folks who like to have community reads, who have a book club, who are looking for a really good read, that it covers a Midwestern family and reasons they left home and reasons they came back and all kinds of things that happened in between. So I think it's going to be a great community read, and we hope that we can encourage lots of people to read and chat about it.
Now, with all the hundreds and thousands of books that are out there, what prompted you all to pick this particular book?
You know, it had just that sweet spot for us of covering, you know, this urban-rural question, and it's a Midwestern story. And one of the things that I think maybe not enough folks are talking about is there has been such a resurgence in terrific Midwestern literature. This is a golden era for Midwestern literature, and we were really excited to choose a book by a Midwestern author.
I know one of the nice things that Indiana Humanities tries to do is try to bring people together to talk and set up conversations of different kinds. And I know that this particular series of Inseparable Initiative, actually the two-year initiative that's underway, has a couple of these chances for people to get together in different communities to talk about. Tell us first about the In Conversation series.
Well, the In Conversation series it sounds like a fancy name, but what it really is a moderated conversation series where we bring in interesting writers and thought leaders and, you know, folks that can help us think about the world in different ways. So our first one that we'll kick off next week, that's part of the series, is an In Conversation with Jim and Deb Fallows. They have written a book called Our Towns. And they are really cool writers. They fly their own small plane, and they flew 400,000 miles around the country, going to communities, mid-size and small, talking to people, interviewing folks, listening, and finding out what is the key to a vital community these days. What communities are responding well to change? What communities are really setting themselves apart? And what is that? You know, what could they observe that maybe other communities could learn from? And so they're coming to Indianapolis, Muncie, Fort Wayne and Angola as part of this tour. So that's just the first one that we'll have over the course of the next 2 years. But look for other opportunities to participate in conversation.
Well, it's interesting that they should have these people with their talk entitled Our Town coming to Muncie in particular, which of course is famous for the Middletown Project, the Lens that came in and did the study back in the 20s and 30s into one particular community and how they chose Muncie to look into how the all-American community should be. It'd be interesting to see what they have to say in relationship of all these years later they see.
You are right on. I mean, that Middletown Studies program was fascinating. And if you look at a lot of national literature, Indiana has often been viewed as that, you know, kind of every town USA kind of model, that we really have been thought of as the middle of everywhere, which is actually, you know, maybe the center of everywhere.
Yeah.
And so they were fascinated by Muncie. And actually, this Our Towns is a book. So if any of your readers out there would like to pick this up, it's available. It's now in paperback. But they do reference Muncie in the book, and the president of Ball State is going to be moderating that conversation, and we know all the Middletown Studies folks are going to be there. So I think it'll be a very rich discussion and certainly something that'll be valuable to the Muncie community as they look at ways to continue to grow and prosper.
We're talking with Kira Amstutz, who's the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities, about Inseparable, which is the next two-year initiative that the organization based in Indianapolis is reaching out across the Hoosier State to deal with. And we talked about this In Conversation series that's underway first. And coming up in April, we know that there's going to be another opportunity for people to sit down over meals and talk about things. What turns into like now the annual Chew on This project is coming up. And one of those stops, by the way, is going to be in Rensselaer. Tell us about the program.
Oh, it is one of my favorite programs. So it's called Chew on This, and the theme of this one, not surprisingly, based on our conversation, is what divides us. So on April 23rd, you can sign up to be part of this dinner discussion series. As you mentioned, you'll have one up in Northwest Indiana in Rensselaer, but we'll have 8 other locations around the state all meeting at the same time, all having the same kind of conversation. And the way this works is you pay a small fee for the dinner, and we have a wonderful facilitator at each location who can lead the group in conversation. It's kind of like dining with strangers, but it's so much fun. And you often walk away with a new friend, a new perspective, a new appreciation for perhaps a great restaurant in your community. And I encourage everyone to check it out and sign up.
Now, kind of going along with the idea of urban and rural, we know small Indiana towns get a chance to participate in all of this over the next couple of years with a traveling Smithsonian curated exhibit. Tell us about Crossroads, Change in Rural America.
See, I told you there are a million components of this program. So, again, we're finding lots of ways for everybody to plug in. So we are incredibly proud that we were able to work with the Smithsonian to bring this exhibit to Indiana. And it's called Crossroads, Change in Rural America. It is going to help the communities that host it think a little bit about how rural America has changed over time. And then each community that's hosting will be able to create a component of the exhibit that's very personal to their community and their place. And right now we have, there are 6 hosts. And the way this program works is the communities that host it need to be smaller than 15,000. So this is a tremendous opportunity for our smaller rural areas to get to host a museum-quality, amazing exhibit with the support of the Smithsonian behind it. So the 6 sites are Dillsboro, Indiana, or the Aurora Public Library in Dillsboro, Washington County Historical Society in Salem. We have Jennings County Historical Society in Vernon. Up north, we've got Elkhart County Historical Museum in Bristol, North Manchester Center for History in North Manchester, and then finally one other Southern Indiana site, the historic New Harmony, folks will be hosting it. So this will happen between September of this year and June of next year. It's a beautiful exhibit. Each of the hosts will do tons of programming around it, have speakers, have tours, have lots of opportunities to engage. But again, we're really jazzed that we were able to talk the Smithsonian in to bring in the exhibit here.
And I know the information here that the Indiana Humanities has put out talks about not only having an opportunity for people to see exhibits and talk about the issues, but filmmakers can get involved in putting together some work as well, too, to bring these stories of rural and urban and suburban Hoosiers together. Tell us about the film project.
Well, the film project is very exciting, and this is where we are looking for creativity. So if you know a filmmaker out there, will you please have them contact us? All of your listeners, please, filmmaker in your life, have them connect with us. We are looking for filmmakers who can help us understand the rural, urban, suburban dynamic in Indiana, and this is why we need excellent storytellers. These are going to be short films. But again, we will. We have a call right now for filmmakers. So if you fill out the call and we select you, we have resources that can help you put your film together. And then we did a similar project recently with the focal point being the White River. And not only do we help support the filmmakers in making the films, but when they're done, we have film release parties. We share them widely. It's a really great way to tell stories, which is a big part of what the humanities do. And we're incredibly excited to be able to involve filmmakers in this journey.
And we know there are a couple other points, too, I'd like to bring up that will get the public involved in the questions that will be brought up during this inseparable two-year initiative. One of them is a poster, and the other are getting speakers lined up. Tell us first about the poster program that's going to be underway, and then about the Speakers Bureau.
Okay, so if you are working in a school or a library, no worries, it's going to be automatically sent to you. And so one of the things that we like to do with our themed programs is create some kind of cool visual poster that helps illustrate some of the information and the facts that we're, you know, kind of basing the conversation on. So this particular poster is really cool. It helps us understand the changing demographics of our state over the past 100 years. And it's beautifully done. We worked with Muncie Map Company to create it, some very talented folks there. And it is free, so if you're interested in getting one of these gorgeous posters, you can contact us at indianahumanities.org, our website, and request one, and we'll send it to you. But if you are with a library or a school, we will send them to every school and library in the state for free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the Speakers Bureau is something interesting. That's something brand new, I understand.
It is brand new, and I spent a lot of time yesterday going through all, it's essentially a catalog online where if you would like to bring in a speaker to think about any of the issues that you and I have talked about today and more, we have what's called the Speakers Bureau. So we have a catalog of speakers. You look through that, you say, oh my gosh, that speaker idea sounds amazing. This person sounds amazing. I'd like to host them at my school, at my community center, at my neighborhood meeting. You apply to us to host. It's a very short application. You say what speaker you'd like to hear and basically when. And then if we select your community to be a host, we'll pay for that speaker to come and present. And your job is to get folks there and to make the most of it. So it's a really wonderful opportunity. We're delighted to have enough funding to do that. And there are dozens of speakers in this catalog with some just incredible talks. So please check it out and let us know if you would like to apply.
Once again, Inseparable is a two-year Indiana Humanities Initiative. It invites Hoosiers to look into how we relate to each other across boundaries, whether they're real, whether they're in someone's imagination or whatever, and to be able to look into what it would take to become inseparable in all of the ways that seem to matter. And this initiative is like many of the others that the Indiana Humanities has had. The last one that we've talked about, and we've actually had programs on the air about, was the Quantum Leap program, which kind of dealt into STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math, science, medicine fields. What kind of response can you tell us that you have received from this past initiative that just ended?
I'm so grateful that you ask. And again, thank you so much. It was wonderful being able to partner with your station to air. If you heard the Quantum Leap sound bites, I know we had some of our audio storytelling that appeared on the station, and I think that was a fun element of the program. But just as a quick snapshot, we did a statewide read of Frankenstein. So our book last year was Frankenstein. It was the 200th anniversary. We had over 600 programs statewide that
That's
reached
right.
thousands and thousands of people. I can't even begin to tell you how much excitement there was out there for thinking about that book, thinking about the impact today, how we think about the limits of science, how we understand you know, how we understand our world and otherness through that book. And it was really magical to celebrate Mary Shelley's book 200 years later with such a big party.
Well, now, Kira, you have time left just to tell us what the website address is and where people can find out more in particular about all of these elements of the Inseparable Initiative that will be taking place now.
Well, the best place to go is to our website. That's indianahumanities.org. And you can find links to all of the programs that I've mentioned. And if you have any questions at all, there's a staff list. Reach out to us. We'll be happy to help.
Kira Amstutz is the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities, based in Indianapolis. And thank you for joining us today to talk about Inseparable, looking into ways that we can find out more about the very interesting urban and rural dynamic that is Indiana.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me on.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It hasn't been long ago that President Trump signed the paperwork that in turn, of course, approved of the appropriations bill, but it also meant something very important to Northwest Indiana. It helped establish an effort that Congressman Pete Visclosky and other people on Capitol Hill from Indiana have been working on for ages, it seems like, and that is to basically rename the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore to become Indiana's National Park. In fact, the 61st National Park in the country, Indiana Dunes National Park. And we now know that many organizations are so happy about this, and one of them is Indiana Dunes Tourism. And we have the Executive Director of Indiana Dunes Tourism with us, Lorelei Weimer, to talk about it. Lorelei, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for inviting us. We're always excited to be able to talk about some of the cool things that are happening in our area.
Well, this is a project that I know you have and others with the Indiana Tourism have been champions of for a long time, probably just as long, if maybe even not longer, than Congressman Visclosky might have been. Knowing that this is so important to help give that sense of being for the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, which has been there since the National Park System, I think just about the time it got created, not long after. So it's been around for a while, but this is just taking it to the next level. What seems to have been the thoughts about all of the work that was done up to the point where President Trump made it official?
You know, it's a huge thank you, and just have a great debt of gratitude for Congressman Visclosky, because he's been at this, and probably well beyond 20 years, of trying to make this a reality. And you know, Congressman Visclosky really understands the value of what we have in Northwest Indiana with the Indiana Dunes and the Lake Michigan, southern shore of Lake Michigan. And so the fact that he's worked tirelessly on this and was able to get it in the budget to make this a reality is so awesome. You know, he recognized that this is a very significant park to the point that it needed to be elevated and be in that elite group of national parks that we see across the nation.
I know that Congressman Visclosky didn't really seem, well, he may have been a bit disgruntled, maybe a little disappointed when things didn't happen in the last session where the measure kind of got set aside, but he worked hard and it ended up getting fit into something, which of course ended up being the appropriations bill that was approved. And I'm sure that probably he's trying to get the word back to everybody back home, said, don't be discouraged. We'll get this through.
And that's exactly it. You know, we were hoping it was going to happen last year. He got it through the House, but it didn't make it through the Senate. So we knew that he was going to gear up yet again this year. And so we were ready to do what we needed to do to help him with this effort. And then before we knew it, I mean, seriously, we were all caught by surprise, a very pleasant surprise, to know that it was in the budget and that it got approved. So, you know, it just, Christmas came early this year in 2019 mm-hmm. with that designation, because it is very significant to our area.
Now, obviously, and we've talked about this before in past conversations, the fact that the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, as it was known then, is not the best-kept secret in the park system. It's just not been one of those things that has gotten a lot of attention until it's become actually an official national park. Many millions of people have gone to the lakeshore to take a look at it, and this is probably going to even be more so now that it has gotten this elevation to an official national park.
Absolutely. You know, so one of the things that has been our stance in terms of why it should be a national park is that, yes, we don't have the acreage that some of the Grand Canyon and the Yellowstones have in terms of just sheer size. But when you look at the visitation with the national park and the state park together, it's 3.6 million visitors, and 80% of those are coming from outside of Northwest Indiana, and 60% are coming from outside the state of Indiana. So it is, when you look at just pure recreational visitors, we are seventh in the nation in terms of the national parks. We're just under Yellowstone. But that's just one of the stories. The other stories is we are one of the most biodiverse areas in North America. And that's a huge story, Chris, as well. So when you look at the complexity of the dunes and what we have in this area, this is a status that we should have gotten years ago. So it should have happened years ago, but we're now excited that it's happened now. But, yeah, we definitely, just with the visitation and the diverse ecology that's here, we are definitely should be among the elite.
Now, what does this mean as far as Indiana Dunes tourism is concerned? Because your effort, of course, is to help push, promote, and highlight tourism efforts in Northwest Indiana, in the area in particular, in this case, around the Indiana Dunes National Park. What kind of efforts will this help, I guess, in a way, to help make your job easier in promoting tourism?
You know, people who travel, there's a lot of people that one of their bucket list items is to visit all the official national parks, which now there are 61. And so now, from a marketing perspective, we want to make sure that when we're highlighting the Indiana Dunes, we make it really clear that we are the 61st national park in the nation, so that we need to be added to that bucket list. So that's significant from our perspective in terms of making sure that people are aware that we are now an official national park.
Now, will this make any marketing initiatives or efforts a little easier to accomplish?
Well, so the first thing that we did to take advantage of this, Chris, is that we wanted to make sure that the state of Indiana knew that we got this distinction. And so we did some digital advertising last week regarding this. But what we did was then we teamed up our Dunes 101 video series. So it's interesting. We have a lot of people that are coming to the Indiana Dunes, but the number one question that we get in our visitor center, and our visitor center is right outside the state park, and it's an effort between us and the national park. So our rangers are working side by side with our visitor center staff. And the number one question we get is, what are the Indiana Dunes and how do you enjoy them? So because of that, we created a Dunes 101 video series that really answers those questions and really tells people how to get the best enjoyment out of the dunes. So as we were really celebrating this new distinction that we have for the national park, we also made sure people knew about the Indiana Dunes one video series and made sure we pointed them in that direction.
Now, will you have to do some updating, revising maybe of the Dunes 101 video series to note the changes and important changes now that that the Indiana Dunes National Park is out there?
Yeah, so what we're going to do, Chris, is we're going to kind of follow the same suit of the National Lakeshore, is as things are normally going to be updated, then we will make the name changes. So there will be some things that are already printed, and we're going to just let those, you know, run out, and then we're going to make all those changes when new things are coming forward. So the Dunes 101 just launched, and so we will take a look at if there's other changes that we need to make. We want to go in one fell swoop. So all of those things will eventually get changed at the appropriate time, but that is on our task list as well, to make sure all these things get the appropriate title added to them.
Now, finally, Lorelei, just one last question to ask. What kind of reaction, and maybe more than response, you've gotten from some of your marketing colleagues around the state after the news came out that that Indiana's own national park, the very first national park, happened to be up here in Northwest Indiana? There probably had to be some rather disgruntled, maybe even envious and jealous people in central Indiana saying, why didn't we get that? You know, they're probably muttering a lot to themselves about this, too. You know, why didn't it happen here instead of in Northwest Indiana?
You know, it actually has been the opposite. We have had people just today. I just opened up my mail today and I got a congratulations letter from Lakeshore Chamber out of Lake County. And that's been more the sentiment. I know the governor of the state of Indiana, Governor Holcomb, put on his Facebook right when it happened. He was so proud, you know, that Indiana, it's our only national park. So I think it's actually been the opposite. The fact that it's now our only national park in the state of Indiana, people all over the state are celebrating it. And that's why, Chris, we actually did a Facebook ad throughout the state, because we want everybody to be excited about what we have here in Northwest Indiana, because it is Indiana's it's Indiana's attraction, and it's in the state, and they own that. So we wanted everybody, so it has really elevated it on a positive level. I think the other thing that we were just a little bit caught off guard with, which on a very positive note, is the press nationwide and internationally that has happened because of this. And, you know, we're tracking all the exposure that we're getting. And we didn't know, Chris, with so much going on nationally, you know, where would this fit into the stories? And it's just hitting everywhere. I just looked at an article from the UK. I looked at an article from Travel and Leisure, which is a pretty significant travel publication online that, you know, and it's also a magazine. So that's what has been just such a pleasant surprise, is how much exposure this has given our national park.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great way to get into the tourism season, at least where warmer weather fits into things. People will have a chance to come up to Northwest Indiana. They'll have more to see, of course, when the weather gets warmer, but they'll also have now this 61st National Park, the one that's in Indiana, along Lake Michigan. So it'll be interesting to see what efforts that you get to add to that with any promotions and the like when the weather gets warmer.
Yeah, you're going to see our marketing is definitely going to change in terms of elevating, you know, what we have here. But, you know, the other thing it allows us to do, Chris, is also tell that biodiversity story.
Yeah.
And the timing has been perfect because we are taking our Beyond the Beach Discovery Trail and we're taking it to the next level. And that started last year, but a lot of that effort's really kicking into gear this year. So the timing of all of this has just been really perfect in terms of the efforts that we're doing to promote the area.
Well, Lorelei, it's a great way to be able to get the next tourism season started here in Northwest Indiana. And we thank you for spending some time to talk about all of this today.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate all the support you give us.
Lorelei Weimer is the Executive Director for Indiana Dunes Tourism. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for joining us. And tomorrow is going to be a Best of Regionally Speaking program. We're going to feature, among other things, a conversation with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. And we'll bring you a legislative alert concerning a measure that is working its way through the General Assembly, through the Senate and the House now, that would affect, if it's enacted into law, Lake Michigan communities. We hope you can join us tomorrow for the program.